Have you phoned the police?
They didn't take it seriously, she said. They understand stolen cars. They don't understand stolen musical instruments.
Well, hey, folks, how you doing? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour on Sunsounds of Arizona. I hope you're doing well. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Michael Bracken bring us our first story. It's called Bermuda Triangle. Erica Witherspoon had asked to meet at Coda's, an upscale drinking establishment two blocks from the concert hall she managed. And I was sitting in a back booth finishing a gin and tonic when she walked in. I don't know what I was expecting, but what I saw approaching wasn't it. In her heels, she easily topped 6 feet, long black hair brushed her shoulders, and a blue pinstripe skirt that hugged every curve. I tried to slide from the booth before she could reach me, but I wasn't fast enough.
"Don't get up," Witherspoon said.
She slid into the booth opposite me and pointed to my glass. "What are you drinking?" I told her. She caught the waitress's attention, pointed to my glass, and said,
"Two more of those."
My gaze could have settled anywhere, but we had business to discuss, so I took a measured breath and focused my attention on her eyes, blue-gray eyes that stared back at mine. And I was thankful the waitress's arrival with our drinks gave me a reason to look away.
"My tab," Witherspoon told the waitress, "his first one, too."
"Yes, ma'am,"
the young woman said as she walked away. I asked Witherspoon why she had wanted to meet.
"Your mama is performing with the orchestra on Saturday," Witherspoon said.
"The cello player?" She shook her head before explaining that Yo Mama was a comedy act that toured the country performing with symphony orchestras. They perform mashups of classical and modern music. Think of them as the classical music world's version of Weird Al Yankovic. I couldn't imagine what the results might be, and I didn't try. My idea of great music began with the Beatles and ended with the Stones. I suggested as much. "You'll never truly appreciate Beethoven's Fifth until you've heard it performed on harmonica, triangle, and ukulele."
"So, why call me?"
"Yo mama's triangle is missing."
I thought triangles were for kindergartners and calling ranch hands to dinner, but I kept my opinion to myself.
"So what's a new one cost? A couple of bucks?"
"Couple of hundred," Witherspoon said. "But cost isn't the issue. We would gladly purchase a new one for Yo Mama, but..."
"But there's something special about this particular triangle?"
"Yes."
"Have you phoned the police?"
"Well, they didn't take it seriously," she said. "They understand stolen cars. They don't understand stolen musical instruments."
"Was it insured?"
"Jerome Young doesn't want money. He wants his triangle."
I hesitated for a beat. Then I said,
"I think I can orchestrate a recovery."
Witherspoon smiled. "I think you're going to be the right man for the job." By the time we finished our drinks, I had a cash retainer and a signed contract in my jacket pocket. I also had Witherspoon's business card with her personal cell phone number inked on the back. I only had one cell phone, so there was no need to write anything on the back of mine. Half an hour later, as we stood on the concert hall's stage, Witherspoon introduced me to Yo Mama, three middle-aged men of varied ethnic heritage. Warren Mabry was the group's harmonica and wind instrument player. Ed Masamoto, its ukulele and other stringed instruments player. And Jerome Young, its percussionist. Warren Mabry and Ed Masamoto glanced at each other as Young asked,
"A private eye?"
"Mr. Hayden will be instrumental in the investigation," Witherspoon explained to the three men.
I turned to Young. I understand the symphony is willing to replace your instrument, I said. But you insist you want the original triangle returned. What's so special about it?
It's one of the infamous Bermuda triangles, Young explained. It's even better than an Allen Abel triangle. Bermuda triangles are the Stradivarius of triangles.
I suspected he was pulling my leg, so I watched his face for signs of amusement. I didn't see any.
There are less than a dozen remaining, and they disappear or become damaged. The remaining Bermuda triangles, they grow in value.
And the value of this one would be?
Tens of thousands of dollars.
And what's so special about it?
It rings with a sound so pure it makes grown men cry.
The way you play, Mabry said, a lot of men cry.
Young shot a dirty look at the harmonica player before continuing. It was my father's and his father's before him. In fact, my father was famous for his performance of the triangle solo in Franz Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 1 in E-flat major. The New Haven Phil won a Grammy for their recording, and it was all because of my father's performance.
Masumoto snorted. You certain it wasn't because of the pianist?
I sensed tension between the three men, but it might have been just the frustration over the loss of an instrument.
Witherspoon injected, We need to find Mr. Young's triangle before Saturday's performance. Where would you like to start?
The three members of Yo Mama had their own dressing rooms, and Witherspoon led us to Young's. He had several percussion instruments, bongos, congas, cowbell, tabla, tambourine, woodblock, and cymbals of various sizes, arranged on a folding table. At the end, next to an unopened black music folder, was a teak box. He opened the box to show me the felt-lined interior where his 9-inch diameter Bermuda triangle and 4 metal beaters would have been. 3 metal beaters of various thickness remain nestled in their spaces, but the space where the triangle should have been and the space where one of the beaters should have been were empty.
Who has access to the dressing room?
Well, anyone backstage, Witherspoon said. So, well, practically anyone. Musicians, stagehands, staff.
And when did you notice it was gone?
This morning, Young said. As soon as we arrived, I checked everything. Then we went to breakfast. When we returned, my triangle was gone.
And where did you eat?
Rondo's. 2 blocks south, Witherspoon explained. The breakfast buffet is to die for.
I saw nothing else of interest in Young's dressing room, so I visited the dressing rooms of Yo Mama's other two members. Warren Mabry had several harmonicas, a bansuri, a didgeridoo, an Irish flute, a kazoo, a piccolo, a recorder, a police whistle, and a few traditional lung-powered orchestral instruments. Ed Masumoto's instruments were mostly stringed, including a banjo, a dulcimer, a lute, and several other instruments I could not identify. I had them each check their instruments, and they reported nothing amiss. After I finished with Yo Mama, I poked my nose into 2 unoccupied dressing rooms and had a quick tour of the backstage area before Witherspoon led me to her office, where she handed me an electronic key card attached to a lanyard that would grant me access to every part of the concert hall. I'll leave you to do your investigating. After returning to the hallway outside the dressing rooms, I walked from one end to the other. One end led backstage, the other to a door that opened onto another hallway that led to the front of the house. Exiting the doors at either end was easy enough, but each door required a key card for readmission. I let myself backstage, where I found the crew preparing for the upcoming concert, and exited into a hallway on the far side, where the orchestra's musicians had their communal dressing rooms, one for female musicians and the other for male musicians. They were empty, so I returned backstage. A man the size of an upright freezer stopped me.
Who are you and what are you doing back here? I handed him my business card. Miss Witherspoon hired me to find yo mama's missing triangle.
Well, it wasn't one of my guys who took it, he said before identifying himself as Butch Vincent, backstage manager.
Like the rest of the backstage crew, he wore his electronic key card on a lanyard around his neck.
They've been with me for 5 years, and they know not to touch any performer's things without permission.
Even so, I said, which of them were here this morning between the time Yo Mama checked their instruments and the time they returned from breakfast, and which employees entered the hallway leading to the guest artist's dressing rooms?
Well, I'm not certain, he said, but I can get a printout from the security system. I'll show you which key cards logged in and when and where and in the building they went. I'll find you later.
I returned to the hallway outside the dressing rooms, intending to exit at the other end and explore the front of the house. As I stepped through the door, though, a blue-eyed blonde with an armload of black folders clutched across her ample breasts approached from the other end. The folders were larger than presentation folders, 11¾ inches by 14 inches, I later learned, and were designed to hold sheet music. The blonde wore black slacks, a white blouse, and red lipstick, and she had her hair pulled back in a loose ponytail held in place with a hair clip shaped like a treble clef. She eyed me up and down, so I eyed her in return. She spoke first.
You the dick Erica told me about?
I stuck out my hand. Joe Hayden. She shifted the stack of folders and clasped my hand.
After the composer?
I shook my head. After my grandfather. She introduced herself as Amanda Hutton, the orchestra's librarian. Amanda did not look like any librarian I'd ever seen, and I bit my tongue to keep from saying that out loud. Instead, I asked, "What kind of books do you have in the library?"
"Not books, music."
She released my hand and shifted the folders once again.
"I'm responsible for ensuring all the musicians have the correct sheet music and for collecting it after the final performance."
"Noted," I said with a smile. She smiled in return.
"Will I see more of you later?
Oh, I'm certain that can be arranged." She winked and stepped past me. Then I continued my journey to the front of the concert hall, to the area most familiar to symphony patrons. The box office, the lobby bar, and the gift shop. I climbed the stairs to visit the small lobby and small lobby bar outside the balcony entrance, and I rode the elevator back down to the main floor. I met only a few employees, janitorial and maintenance staff mostly, and then exited the building and walked all the way around it to the loading dock where I found Warren Marbury smoking a cigarette and watching the road crew for Captain Kangaroo, the Australian hip-hop group, loading equipment into a semi-trailer. I stepped up beside him and asked, "Nothing to do, huh?" He exhaled a cloud of blue smoke and asked, "You find Jerome's Bermuda?" I shook my head. "You don't seem broken up about it." For a moment he stared at the parking lot behind the building. Then he said, "Having an instrument of that caliber on stage with us is like taking a Ferrari to a go-kart track. We're a comedy act, for goodness sake. I use a plastic kazoo and a comb with wax paper." "You think Mr. Young deserves what happened?"
"Deserves is too strong a sentiment, Mr. Hayden. Let's just say Jerome's luck ran out. Any instrument that valuable requires better security than Jerome ever gave it. I mean, it's a Bermuda Triangle, and they've been disappearing for years."
Before I could ask Marbury what he meant, the loading dock door opened, and the upright freezer named Butch stepped through. He held out a half-inch-thick stack of continuous-feed computer paper.
"Here's your printout from the security system."
I took it from him, glanced at the top sheet, and saw a list of employees and their key card numbers. I flipped past it to the first page, showing when each employee had passed through which electronic checkpoint. Butch jabbed a thick finger at the list. "Here's what you're looking for, 18 and 19. Them's the doors at each end of the hall outside the guest artist dressing rooms. Anyone entering one door should exit the other. That time of the morning, though, it's a subway station back here." I left Marbury and Butch on the loading dock and took the printout into one of the unoccupied dressing rooms. There I settled into a sprung sofa and worked my way through that morning's list of visitors to the hallway. By the time I finished, I realized Butch was right. Everyone but Beethoven and Tchaikovsky had passed through the hall while Yo Mama was at breakfast. So, if someone had taken the elusive Bermuda Triangle during that brief window of time, they had done so with dozens of potential witnesses barely a baton's length away. If I could figure out who had taken the triangle, then maybe I could figure out why the triangle had been taken. Mabry had mentioned the disappearance of other Bermuda triangles, and I knew just the guy to ask about that. I had a high-end fence on speed dial, a guy I had met while trying to recover a necklace that cost more than my college degree. So I unclipped my cell phone from its holster and called Aaron the American Copeland. After I told him about my case, he said, "Well, there's a black market for stolen musical instruments." "But triangles? Next you'll tell me cowbells are a hot commodity." "You wouldn't believe if I did." He was right. I still wasn't convinced triangles had any value, so Copeland told me about Art Loss Register. With more than 700,000 registered items, the Art Loss Register, based in London, is the world's largest private database of lost, stolen, and looted art, antiques, and collectibles, including approximately 5,000 musical instruments. Most of them were stringed, he explained, but three Bermuda triangles had been added to the list over the years. If reported, Jerome Young's would be the fourth. "Who would want them?" "Ah, a collector," he said. "Just like with any piece of fine art, there's someone somewhere who collects those things." "But they can't put them on display." "Well, they don't need to. Knowing they have something no one else does is enough for them," he said. "Usually." "Usually." "Yeah, there's a difference between a one-of-a-kind piece of art and something with multiple copies. Books, for example. There are only so many first editions. A first edition of an important book becomes more valuable the fewer of them exist. So, it's in a collector's best interest to remove copies from the marketplace, sometimes even to destroy them, thus making their copy more valuable. The same with musical instruments, like the Bermuda Triangle."
"How do you destroy a triangle? Straighten it?"
"Ah, bend it, melt it, cut it into pieces, doesn't matter. Once it's no longer playable, it loses all value, and again, the remaining Bermuda triangles become that much more valuable."
We spoke for a few more minutes, but I learned nothing else of value until,
"You find the missing triangle," Copeland said. "I know a guy who would take it off your hands, no questions asked."
Of course he did. While I was pondering all I had learned from Copeland, I heard ukulele music coming from the dressing room next to the one I was in. I didn't recognize the tune. I left the computer printout on the couch and stepped next door. The door was open, and Ed Masamoto was standing in the middle of the room, ukulele in hands, and a music stand holding sheet music before him. He stopped when he saw me standing in the doorway. "Yes?" Half a dozen cheap ukuleles were on the table behind him. They hadn't been there earlier, and I asked about them. "Oh, they just arrived," he said. "I go all Pete Townsend at the end of the show and smash my ukulele, but not this one." He indicated the one he was holding, which looked the same as the ones on the table. "It's a Steve Urkelele."
A Steve?"
A smile on his face stopped me. "You're pulling my leg."
You're pretty sharp for a dick.
Well, not sharp enough, I told him. I still don't know what happened to your partner's triangle.
He shrugged. I wouldn't be surprised if Jerome hit it somewhere. He likes the attention and probably thought he would get some sympathy from Ms. Witherspoon, maybe cry on her shoulder and see if that led to a little chic music. Or maybe she would leak this to the press, get him a few interviews. Instead, she decided to keep everything sotto voce. I guess that's why she brought you in.
Masamoto continued.
Jerome thinks he's important because he gets top billing.
Well, why does he?
What could we call our act otherwise? Mama Yo? Ma Yo Ma? We were just Mabry and Masamoto before he joined us. We doubled our gigs after the name change.
I learned that a performance hall isn't a 9-to-5 operation. Even so, when there were no evening events scheduled, much of the staff left at the end of regular business hours. When there are no evening events scheduled, much of the staff left at the end of regular business hours. I stood on the loading dock out back and watched as they filtered out of the building in a 1 and 2 and 3. A few men carried briefcases, women carried purses, and Amanda Hutton carried a sack of music folders clutched tightly to her chest. Witherspoon caught me watching the sway of Hutton's hips.
She's quite an eyeful, isn't she?
Startled, I turned to my client. Witherspoon placed a finger against my lips and said,
"Call me later for a debriefing session."
I waited until most of the day staff had left before walking down the street to Rondo's, the diner with pretensions where Yo Mama had eaten breakfast. I ordered an overpriced burger with a side of sweet potato fries, and I ate while I pondered what I had learned that afternoon. I decided I didn't have much to report. Despite that, I phoned the private cell phone number inked on the back of Witherspoon's business card. She invited me to her apartment. When I arrived, I regretted not splashing on some cologne and putting a fresh shirt on under my rumpled suit jacket, because I found the symphony's music librarian sitting on the couch sipping a cosmopolitan, and neither woman was dressed as they had been earlier in the day. Witherspoon wore a blue silk robe that clung to her in all the right places, and, though less provocatively dressed, Amanda's cleavage, seen for the first time not hidden behind a clutch of music folders, drew my attention into its depths. Witherspoon asked, "Drink, Mr. Hayden, or should I call you Joe?"
"Oh, Joe is fine," I said, "and yes to the drink."
Amanda patted the empty couch, cushioned beside her.
"Well, now why don't you sit with me?"
I had just settled onto the couch next to Amanda when Witherspoon handed me a gin and tonic. Then she settled onto the couch on my other side and rested her hand on my knee.
"So what have you learned today?"
"Nothing concrete," I said. "Ma and Ma think Yo might have taken the triangle himself to get attention."
Amanda's hand settled onto my other knee.
"And what do you think?"
"It's possible," I said.
I still held the gin and tonic, and I wasn't certain what to do with my hands.
"I don't have any better ideas."
Witherspoon smiled and said, "I do." Then she slipped away, retrieved an LP from an extensive collection, and soon the unmistakable sounds of Bolero, one of the most sensuous classical pieces ever written, issued from a pair of Bose speakers. Witherspoon rejoined us and asked,
"Why don't we take this to the main stage?"
After I put down my drink, Amanda and I rose from the couch. The music librarian kissed me lightly on the cheek and said,
"Oh, I wish I could join you, but I have to visit my father first thing in the morning."
As Amanda let herself out of the apartment, Witherspoon led me into her dimly lit bedroom. Afterward, my client instigated pillow talk. She wanted to know how I'd become a private investigator, which was a long, boring story that I did my best to spice up. In return, I asked her how she and Amanda came to be in their positions. Witherspoon had a degree in business administration and had been employed by other performing arts organizations before becoming manager of the concert hall 4 years earlier. Amanda, on the other hand, had been born into a musical family. Her mother had been a flautist and her father a percussionist. According to Witherspoon, Amanda had never been good enough with the violin to make a living performing, and a chance opportunity while in college altered her career trajectory. From a part-time librarian position with a small orchestra in Texas, she had moved through two other ever-larger organizations until she landed at the orchestra that officed and performed at the hall Witherspoon managed.
"She took this job to be close to her father," Witherspoon explained. "After her mother's passing, he hasn't been able to care for himself, and now he's in a home."
I started to ask another question, but Witherspoon interrupted me.
"Enough talking," she said as her hand slid down my abdomen. "You think you're ready to conduct an encore?"
The next morning, after stopping at my place for a shower and a change of clothes, I phoned Copeland to ask if he'd heard anything about the missing triangle. He hadn't, which let me know that whoever took it wasn't a pro. That refocused my attention on Yo Mama and the symphony's employees, so I spent some time online learning what I could about Amanda Hutton's father. He had been with New Haven Phil for several years and had left when it became obvious he would never be a principal. He later took a position with the orchestra for which Amanda now served as librarian and had retired several years prior to her hiring. Then I turned my attention to Jerome Young and his father. When I finished, I returned to the hall and cornered Young. "Your partners think you arranged the disappearance of your triangle to get attention and maybe a little sympathy from Erica Witherspoon." He glared at me. "I don't need to stoop that low."
"There's some question about why you left your tenured position."
"I wanted to do something different, and the Mas needed a third to complete their act." I interrupted.
"You certain it didn't have something to do with a second violinist who claimed?"
"Claimed?" He crossed his arms. "Nothing was ever proven because nothing ever happened."
"Well, word has it that you should have been a conductor because you were waving your baton at every eligible female."
He smiled. "Well, yeah, there was a time," he said, "when I could score with ease, but I would never fake the theft of a Bermuda just to get a woman's attention." We stared at each other for a moment before I took our conversation in another direction.
"Do you remember any of the percussionists who performed at the New Haven Phil with your father?"
He shook his head. "No, I was just a kid."
"Does the name Hutton chime your triangle?"
"No. Why?"
"Stan Hutton left the Phil a year after your father joined. There's no indication Hutton performed on the recording of Liszt's Piano Concerto No. 1 that won the Phil a Grammy."
Young shrugged. "Still, don't remember him." Amanda arrived at 10:30 that morning, and she carried a dozen music folders clutched to her chest as she walked in from the parking lot. I hadn't thought anything of it when I had seen her leaving the previous evening with the music folders, and until that morning I couldn't figure out why she would have taken music home with her. So I watched from a distance as she entered the building through the loading dock, and I followed discreetly as she made her way toward the dressing rooms. Because Yo Mama was on stage, the three men involved in an intense discussion with Butch Vincent as they pointed at the spotlights, I knew the dressing rooms would be unoccupied. By the time I reached the hallway, it was empty. Amanda had had enough time to traverse the length of it and exit at the other end, but I suspected she hadn't. I quietly opened the door to Young's dressing room and watched as she placed the music folders on the table, removed the missing Bermuda triangle and the missing beater from one of the folders, and returned them to the teak box where they belonged. I closed the door behind me and flipped the lock. Amanda spun around, her eyes widening in surprise.
"Why did you bring it back?"
"I didn't steal the Bermuda," she said. "I only borrowed it."
"Not everyone would see it that way," I said. "They might think you returned it out of remorse for what you'd done."
"For what I did?"
She stared straight into my eyes.
"I made my father happier than I've seen him in years. He never had a chance after Jerome Young's father was hired by the New Haven Phil. How could he? Young had a Bermuda Triangle."
"So you took it for him?"
"So I took it so my father could play it. And when he did, I saw the biggest smile on his face, the first time he smiled since my mother passed." She took a deep breath. "What happens now?"
"Now?" I asked. "Now you pick up your folders and continue to the library. I'm going to find yo mama and let them know I found the missing triangle and have returned it to its proper place."
I mean, what about me?"
"How's your father?"
"He won't see the new year."
I did the math. 6 months tops.
"You can't tell Erica," she said. "I'll lose my job. Worse, I'll lose her."
I unlocked the door.
"Go."
Amanda didn't hesitate. She scooped up her music folders and hurried down the hall. I corralled the three members of Yo Mama. Then I phoned Witherspoon and asked her to meet us in Young's dressing room. Once the five of us were gathered, I opened the teak box to show them that the Bermuda Triangle had been returned to its rightful place. Witherspoon, Mabry, and Masumoto peppered me with questions. I deflected as best as I could by implying that a fence I knew had given the triangle to me on the condition that I not reveal his name. Young paid no attention to this. He took the triangle from the box and examined it carefully. Then he picked up one of the beaters and began playing. Bermuda triangles might be the Stradivariuses of triangles, and Jerome Young might be one of the world's greatest percussionists. But when I heard the clanging, all I could think about was a passel of cowhands loping into the ranch house for supper. I turned to Witherspoon and suggested we go somewhere for lunch. She rested her hand on my forearm.
"I know just the place."
Where they tangoed under a fermata. They're musical terms, folks. Don't send me hate mail. Just keeping with the puns of the story. And ending with some percussion music. All right, turning now to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, a story called Red Dog, and it's written by Bill Connor. Jennifer and I sat apart on the front steps of the bank as the summer night wrapped us in its darkness. She looked worried.
"I looked everywhere. Someone took it."
We kept the fund in a Folgers can with a plastic lid on a side table in Red Dog's communal kitchen. It was the money we used to buy water at a public well in Ashforth, 20 miles away. Without the water we hauled in, we were finished.
"We're due for water run tomorrow, Doc. You got to figure out who took the fund and get it back. You got to do that tonight."
Not an easy task. We were mostly loners in Red Dog, each as unique and alike as pebbles in a stream bed. If the shadow of suspicion attached itself to the wrong person, they'd never outlive it, no matter how innocent they were. A loud, compressive noise detonated far in the distance. We knew all the sounds that went with living on the prairie, and that one didn't belong. Jennifer said, "That a storm?" She stood and scanned the sky for heat lightning. Red Dog hides away 100 miles north of Amarillo, close to the Oklahoma Panhandle. On a high-res satellite photo, it might show up as a smudge. It does not appear on any road maps I've ever seen. If you find it, well, consider yourself lost. 12 of us live here in the old buildings that had once been the town of Chewilla, before corporate farms dried up the wells and drove the settlers out. Hank and Lila walked outside and stood in the street curious about the noise. Henry, their dog, barked once. Lila made wind chimes she sold at craft fairs. Hank sold his handmade flutes alongside her. Lila called, "What was that?" There were 2 distant pops just at the threshold of my hearing. Hank called out, "Gunshots." I said, "Maybe we should get inside." Jennifer studied me. "It's too hot. If it's trouble, it'll come inside after us." None of us had air conditioning, but we had power. Some bureaucrat in Austin managing a tiny sliver of the state budget for rural electrification kept a wire into Red Dog hot and sent us a monthly bill to our post office box in Ashforth. The noise started up again. I held my breath as I listened. "Every little bit of excitement doesn't mean trouble, Doc." "Well, what does it mean?" "Just means the world is turning." I asked Jennifer to marry me 3 years ago, and she hasn't yet answered. I believe it's because I come across as too cautious, and she'd always hoped for something else. Hank called, "Coming this way." Lila slipped past him into what had once been a farmer's workshop with a brick forge. They'd fixed it up into a comfortable home. The noise became a roar, and there were lights swinging on the horizon. Jennifer said, "Well, I hope it's a UFO." "What would you say to them?" "I'd say, 'You're lost, bud.'" "I don't think explorers get lost. Being lost is their occupation." She smiled. "Well, then I'd say howdy." But it wasn't a UFO. It was a broken-down pickup with Oklahoma plates that had sheared its exhaust at the headers, making it infernally loud. 2 drunk cowboys slammed out of the pickup and shot at the sky with their pistols to let us know they meant business. The big one reeked of Corazon Blanco, and his face was burned red from the sun. He swayed a little where he stood and had a screw you kind of attitude, as though he knew deep down he'd reached the end of his rope. "We come to rob your bank." The bank is my home. A 1-story brick building fronting the town's only street. There are granite facings around the front door and bank carved into the granite header. There's a teller's window inside and pine wood floors and a safe that I've tried to crack 1,000 times with all the combination attempts chalked on the steel sides. My neighbors live in a store and the saloon, and in those buildings with solid roofs that they'd given names like Sunshine Terrace and Repose. We keep to ourselves and never have visitors. Red Dog sleeps through the years as quiet as a whisper. I said, "It's a seed bank, not a money bank." The thin one, who could have been a rat if he'd had a tail pointed his pistol at me, says bank. "Used to be. 100 years ago, when this was a town. Now the government pays us to scavenge the fields and the hills for the seeds of plants that grow wild and one time covered the prairie. The genetically modified seeds today are so specialized, they worry that, with global warming, the crops will be wiped out before anyone can react. The ancient plants are more robust. They've seen everything. Well, that's a theory, anyway." The rat spat in the desert. "I want to see those seeds before I shoot you dead." "The government shipped them to Doomsday Vault in Norway. You go to Spitsbergen, Norway. That's where all the seeds are stored for the end of the world." The flat prairie had been baking for weeks. Heat lightning flashed, 6 quick flashes, like someone had called in the artillery strike. I counted the seconds before the thunder rolled in, 10, give or take. 2 miles. We'd have rain before long. It wouldn't solve our water problem. The town's old cistern leaked and was contaminated. The rat swayed.
He's lying, Case.
I said, it's not a bank anymore. Look around. We're poor people. There's no money here. They looked around in the exaggerated way of drunks and found darkness as near as the ends of their fingertips. The lightning pulsed closer. They listened hard and sniffed the breeze. The first wind we'd had in weeks woke up and pushed hard through the town. Lila's wind chimes, strung along the eaves of her place, rang with abandon. The temperature dropped. The wind carried the smell of summer and, a moment later, rain. Lightning flashed all around us. Thunder rolled like a pounding drum. The cowboys looked left and right like someone had played a terrible trick on them. City boys. Jennifer turned to me, a look of concern on her face. I heard it too, behind the thunder and the wind, an unending roar.
The shelter, quick!
I stood and rang the brass bell that hangs next to the bank front door. Jennifer disappeared inside as Henry, the dog, scooted into the alley between the buildings. The rat snapped a shot at me and grazed my upper arm and burned like a red-hot poker had been pressed into it. I followed Jennifer inside around the teller station, past the bank manager's office, down the hall, and out the back door. We'd built the shelter into the side of a hill where there had once been a root cellar. Hank and Lila were inside, with a candle already lit. Mrs. Murphy, 85 if she was a day, inched across the ground. Crazy Bob looked like he was going to pass her, as the wind roared so loud I couldn't think. Ralph walked at his normal pace, the only thing normal about him. His sister Simi, who always followed 2 paces behind, jogged in place so she wouldn't pass him. I scooped up Mrs. Murphy in my arms and told Bob to hang on to me and got them inside as the roof splintered with a noise like the engine room in hell. Jennifer pulled the hatch closed behind me. Everyone's in. She was responsible for the count. I think the old dressmaker shop is gone. I had to shout above the wind, frantic pounding on the hatch. It's those cowboys. Jennifer looked at me like she was asking a question. I said, Hank, help me with the hatch. The two of us got a good grip on the handles and braced ourselves. I nodded. Jennifer slipped the 2x6 from the steel brackets. It was like trying to hold on to a sail in a hurricane. Hank and I let it open a foot. Any more and the hatch would have been ripped off and the twister would have come in after us. The 2 cowboys scrambled inside and we pulled the hatch close and braced it. A spare brace leaned against the earthen wall. I swatted the rat with it and he went down hard. I squeezed into my place on the bench with his pistol cradled in my lap like a new puppy. Crazy Bob said, Why'd you hit him? He shot my arm. It was a small space. Crazy Bob stuck out a leg and kicked the unconscious cowboy. There were 12 of us, red dogs, crammed inside. Jennifer and me, Hank and Lila and their dog, Mrs. Murphy and Crazy Bob, Ralph and Simi, the Ertles, who speak a language none of us know, and Buck and Jody, plus the 2 cowboys. Mrs. Murphy said, It doesn't sound like there will be much left. The hatch vibrated like a monster was trying to claw its way in. I didn't have a chance to pack away my pictures. They'll be gone tomorrow. Tears ran down Mrs. Murphy's worn face. Jennifer said, We'll find them. Don't you worry. The red-faced cowboy, Chase, sat on the floor next to the rat. He looked like the tornado had sobered him up. I said, How'd you find this place? We followed you when you ran. His pistol was gone. He must have lost it running after us. My arm was yelling at me. Blood dripped off my fingertips.
We talked about putting first aid supplies in the shelter, but never did. This is no time to be stupid. How did you find this place? There are no signs. The road is washed out in three places. How did you find us?
Ah, we was driving around raising hell.
And there you were. No. You said you'd come to rob our bank. Who told you we were here? Buck, the quietest of men, said,
Well now, Doc, we're all wondering what'll be left and will we be able to rebuild, and if we can't, what'll happen to us? Is it important to know how they come to be here?
I said, There's nothing we can do about the storm damage till tomorrow morning. There'll be wires down and broken glass. It won't be safe to walk around till daylight. One of us told them we were here, a traitor.
The wind blew as loud as a scream that two of the women and three of the men covered their ears.
Case said, I heard it in a bar someplace. There was a town and they had a bank and a safe was filled with gold, but nobody knew the combination.
What bar?
I was drinking hard, I don't know.
But you remembered the directions on how to get here. If I wrote them out, they'd be four pages long. Now listen to me. Whatever happens to you, no one outside of Red Dog will ever know.
Mrs. Murphy fidgeted with her hands. She'd left her knitting behind and didn't know what to do with them.
Well, it's not like you to be so hard, Doc,
Jennifer said. The fund is missing. I looked everywhere. One of us stole it. It seemed everyone yelled at once. The Ertles murmured to themselves.
Jody pounded her fist on her knee.
That's our money. That's the money we'll need to rebuild.
They looked at each other with suspicious eyes, measuring. I said, It wasn't Bob or Mrs. Murphy. They haven't left Red Dog in years. Long as I stop at the yarn store and the used bookstore in Ashforth, they've got what they need.
6 months ago, Buck and Jody and Ralph and Seamy squeezed into my pickup and we went to town.
Jody said, I had this craving for a burger. It just wouldn't go away, I told Buck, and then he had the craving too. Ralph heard us talking and told Seamy.
Her eyes took on a faraway look.
Oh, best thing I ever ate.
The tension inside the tiny shelter seemed to shift. Crazy Bob said,
You didn't bring us back something?
Seamy spoke for the first time in a week.
I wanted to.
I said, I found the Ertles hiding in the bed of my truck 2 years ago, and they've been here since. They looked at me as silent as owls.
Case said, I don't know nothing about no fund.
It was a woman, wasn't it? Cells form, do their damage, and reform. A twister can cut a swath through a town, then do the same to three more. It can die out and reform and grow until it's the biggest monster in the world. The hatch banged and slammed until the heavy lag screws that held it together were loose. The air racing through the gap sounded like a jet engine spooling up. It had become a thing none of us would survive. I yelled as loud as I could.
She said you'd get the gold after you did the killing. Is that it? She found a man who couldn't hold a job and whispered there'd be enough gold to keep you forever as long as you killed all of us. Why, you had to get this rat to help you because he's not afraid of killing. Why, you had to get falling down drunk first because you are. Why, you're never leaving here.
The hatch pounded and the heavy lag screws dropped to the floor. We were out of time and up to our throats in fear. His eyes cut to Lila. Jennifer saw it, sat straight, and said,
You!
The wind relaxed a little. I said,
She takes the wind chimes to the craft fairs, but it seems like they all come back home with her. She's stopped taking Hank with her when she goes.
The hatch stopped pounding. We no longer had to yell to be heard. I said,
You hired these boys to kill us.
Case shook his head.
I never would have.
Lila said,
Well, it's not like any of you were going to invent a cure for cancer. Bob writes poems that make no sense. Buck and Jody spend all their time growing pot, then smoking it. Ralph uses every bit of his energy hating the rest of us, and Seamy goes along because she's a mouse. The old lady doesn't have much longer. The Ertles don't even know what country they're in. Sleeping next to Hank all these years is like being in a coma, and you, Doc, made a full-time career out of doing nothing but daydreaming about Jennifer. Like that's ever gonna happen. Who in the world would miss any of you? The fund will get me far away from this place and set me up in a new business and a new life. And that's just what's going to happen.
She reached behind her and pulled out a pistol.
You gonna shoot me, Doc? I don't think so. In all my life, I never seen a man more afraid of the present.
She cocked the hammer, extended her arm, and aimed at my face across the narrow, dark shelter. Her finger went white on the trigger as I shot her through the heart, everyone jumping at the loud bang. Mrs. Murphy blessed herself. Bob asked her if she was okay. Jennifer's eyes were as big as marshmallows as she scooped up Lila's pistol. The Ertles huddled closer. Hank cried. Seamy pointed to Ralph and said, "Shoot him next. I can't live with him one more day." Buck whispered, "Oh, jeez." Jody said, "Now what?" I said, "If we can make buildings habitable enough, we can stay. The ones we've been living in were built out of solid timbers and brick. Right this minute, we should be hopeful." Mrs. Murphy said, "I won't allow any more killing. I just won't." Jody said, "What do we do with them?" Mrs. Murphy told us. Jennifer waved the pistol to get everyone's attention. "The fun's gone. We can't live here 2 more days without water." I said, "When Lila kept coming back with all her wind chimes unsold, I wondered what was going on. Then she started acting odd, forgetting her chores, keeping to herself, acting like she was waiting for something big to happen. 2 days ago, I emptied out the Folgers can, stuffed it full of socks, and put the fund in the safe." At dawn, Red Dog looked like it had lost a hard fight. But we thought we could scavenge enough materials from the unused buildings to fix up our homes. I made up a list of materials to buy in Ashforth. Hank set off alone to bury Lila someplace quiet. I hitched the water trailer to my pickup. Jennifer rode shotgun. Case and the rat were trussed up in the bed and covered with a tarp. We headed up to Oklahoma and followed farm roads until they petered out, then dirt tracks until we feared we'd never find our way home. We unloaded the two killers with a jug of water. Jennifer tossed a rusty steak knife into the dirt. "If you managed to get loose, it would be best if you head east and make the water last." We crossed back into Texas with the sun in our eyes and Patty Loveless on the radio trying to break my heart. Jennifer reached over, turned down the volume. "You told that cowboy it was a woman. Did you think it was me?" The hot wind blew through the open window, smelling of alfalfa. "I can't ever tell what's on your mind." 10 miles later, she turned down the volume on Reba. "Pull over." I did, and as the dust settled around us, she scooched across the bench seat and kissed me like she'd been saving it up. "Okay, let's get that water." Well, friends, that's going to do it for this Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler here saying, thanks so much for joining me and tune in again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.